Hey, this is Poets Cafe. I'm Aram Saroyan, and I'm talking today with Holly Prado Northup and her husband, Harry Northup. And it's a pleasure to welcome you both.
Thank you, Aram.
Thank you.
Now, Holly, tell me about this new poem.
This is a manuscript of poetry from 2014, and the title of the whole is Rogue Star. We were just chatting a little bit before we went on the air about Harry's background with Beyond Baroque, the early history of L.A. poetry, and my experience with high school teaching and then working in a poetry workshop with Alvaro Cardona Hine.
Who is he? I'm sorry.
He is a poet, musician, painter. He and his wife, Barbara Hughes, now live in New Mexico and have for a very long time.
I've heard his name, but I wasn't sure.
He was close to poets here in Los Angeles, poets of the 50s and 60s, Gene Frumkin, Tom McGrath, some people whose names are probably not familiar to your listeners, but they were very important at the moment.
Well, I know both those names just from the poetry scene,
right,
but
right.
How much interaction did you have with that generation?
Not much. Alvaro led a once-a-week workshop. He worked full-time. He had an ex-wife and several children to support. He was busy. So every Monday night, he had a small group poetry workshop with his wife, Barbara Hughes, and my long-time poet friend, Amin Alwan, who is still writing in his 80s, and several other people.
And did this eventually evolve into Beyond Baroque?
No, it had nothing to do with Beyond Baroque, except that the first time I went to Beyond Baroque in about 1971 was to hear Alvaro read.
Okay.
And I got lost because at that point the street names were peculiar and I couldn't find my way, but I did. And then when I got there, I thought, oh, this is a poetry home.
And is that the same location that it is today?
No. They moved to the old Venice City Hall in what year, Harry?
Maybe 79 or 80.
I see. And that's where Wanda Coleman was. And
well, she was at the old location.
She was at the old, yeah.
Sure. And Eloise Klein Healy, Jim Crusoe, Bill Moore. Harry will talk more about that, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
But this poem references a time when I was really not aware that I could ever have a life as a writer. I had no idea how desperate I was. The poem tries to say a little something about that. At the time in the 60s, when I remember this scene, I was married to someone who was a musician, and he was carrying all the creative weight of the relationship, and I had not started to really write, and this is how I felt, and it brings it up into the present. After a crisis, sweet, neutral breathing. People who crowded the porch, some dead, most now telling themselves old age isn't so bad. We can't delete memory, we can steady its glare. When I bring that porch, late 1960s, into focus, I see my young loneliness. She wears flowered bell-bottoms. She stands away from the hot dogs, smoking her own cigarettes. Such paltry comfort. Oh, past, you're as translucent as ice we used for drinks, numbing and tasteless. All that was said is mere echo, exploded, then dimmed. How does the pain of removal shift into art? We keep at it. I know. That's a given. I wanted a home where no one expected my pretense, only my native bewilderment. This summer's been brutal, but also abundant. I stand in the kitchen chopping and mixing. Our bodies need food, not a picture of food, not smoke or wild clothes or one cynical guest who poked fun at the lyrical world. He's dead. And if he weren't gone in that way, he'd still be erased from my plans. So then, give memory its distance, its flat, empty hands. Be safe. Be right here. Be hungry for this evening's dinner. It was 1970 when I discovered that right next door was Barbara Hughes and that Alvaro held a poetry workshop there on Monday nights.
And so this is just before that.
Yeah, a couple years before that.
And real despair.
And real despair.
And how much of that has to do or at least connects with the pre-feminist period, or was this a feminist period?
I didn't feel subjugated. I was always pretty independent, and I had a job teaching high school English and so forth. And we were having a typical 1960s time. We were going on peace marches, and we were going to jazz clubs. So it was not dull. It was just that I had no way of recognizing that I could use my creative gifts.
And were you reading at that time? Was there any initiating writing or?
It wasn't until I got into Alvaro's poetry workshop that I was really brought up to date. In college, I had done a lot of writing, and I had studied all of the traditional writers, poets and novelists and so forth.
And you also wrote a novel.
That wasn't until the 1980s. I wrote three novels in the 1980s.
Oh, okay.
One of which was published.
She told me she was going to write a novel. So I said, all right, I'll just go sit in the living room.
And wait. He said, I'll just sit in the living room and wait. He could see my eyes bugging out of my head.
It took her about 9 months to write it. And then there was a woman studying with her. She lived in Malibu. She was friends with an entertainment lawyer. So she suggested this guy. So Holly,
agent.
William Morris, got the book to this guy. Then the guy sent it to Harcourt Brace Jovanovich. And Holly got her first novel published. She never even met the agent. She never met the guy at Jovanovich. And then Jovanovich did the line editing for the first half of the book. And then Holly took it from there.
Fantastic.
Well, it was an adventure in the big world of New York publishing, which did not have a particularly happy ending. But I thought, what a great fluke. What a great fluke. I'm not really a novelist, but wasn't that a nice experience to have?
But listen to this, Arm. Holly has something, and she's got a reservoir inside herself. Whatever she's called upon to write, she can do it. All of a sudden, I don't know when it was. The late 70s? You got a call from Art Seidenbaum, who was the head guy at the book review. He's actually got the book review.
The book review at the Los Angeles Times.
To review books. She never had done it before. She started doing it.
And you mentioned that, or I read that somewhere. And tell me about that, because here we are in this time where the Los Angeles Times book review is kaput.
Yes.
And even while it was still there, at some point, somebody made the decision not to review poetry.
Jack Miles, and Harry can talk about the protest that he organized. And in a week, he had two dozen poets picketing the L.A. Times at noon.
What happened was Jack Miles, Holly had gone from writing reviews, and she had her own column with another poet. They alternated. It was in the L.A. Times book review. And so she wrote a column every so often about poetry. And she would go looking through the bins and find small press mags, books from small presses, and she would review them. And then Jack Miles came along and he said, no more reviews. We're going to publish a poem and give the author $50. So that was on April 12, 1987. So we read that in the Sunday paper. I talked to Holly. I got on the phone. Within 4 or 5 days, we had approximately 24 to 35 poets marching up and down in front of the LA Times. And it got Metro coverage. It got coverage by a French newspaper. They did a mock documentary. It got coverage by the Columbia Journalism Review. And it got over 200 letters, you know, in favor. But it didn't matter.
That was the end.
Well, you know, I had an interesting experience with Jack Miles because I had just moved out in 87 or 88. And this is Poets Cafe. I'm Aram Saroyan, and I'm talking today with Holly Prado and her husband, Harry Northup. I don't know how it happened, but I did a review. And then he had this thing where he assigned a few of us to write a monthly review of some book that the LA Times would send us. And then one day I was summoned to do a lunch with him, and he explained to me with this kind of, you know, he was a very nice man and a good writer, but he was obviously uncomfortable, and in a kind of thoroughgoing way, he explained to me that the publication, the LA Times Book Review, was dependent on ads from publishers.
Right.
And if one reviewed a publisher in a negative way one time too often, they wouldn't take ads out. And
oh
I couldn't
gosh.
Understand
oh,
whether.
I never heard.
I couldn't
that.
Understand whether is
shocking.
He referring to my reviews, because some of them were positive, some of them were negative, you know. But I suspect that he was.
He was warning you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, gee.
And you know, it wasn't like I even said to them at the beginning. I said, "Well, you know, I'm a slow reader. Can you send me some shorter books?" And they'd come in and they'd come in these behemoths, you know, 400-page books about espionage.
And you know, Art Seidenbaum, of course, when he had Jack Miles' position as editor of the Book Review at
the
LA Times.
He had those big saucer eyes. They were almost like freeways.
He told me that they were always struggling for money because advertisers really did not want to advertise in the Book Review. And I thought the LA Times at that time had so much money. Why couldn't they support a decent book review?
Yeah.
A decent book review in a city the size of Los Angeles.
There was this myth that newspapers didn't make any money. They made lots of money.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Well, see, that's the other thing. The LA Times always had an inferiority complex to the New York Times. The New York Times, you know, when they stopped doing their book review a few years ago, I got on the phone and I ordered the New York Times Book Review for $91 a year. And, you know, they cover poetry every once in a while. But, you know, I remember talking to – I won't mention the person's name – when Jack Miles ended his tenure at the Book Review, and we both started singing The Wicked Witch is Dead. but that's another – you know, as I say, that's another story in another country, and besides The Wench is Dead.
And I do want to say that what Harry did in terms of organizing the poets and protesting and the letters that the Times received – I said it didn't matter, but it did matter.
Yeah.
It mattered to those of us who really believe in speaking out and standing up for what is most valuable to us.
See, that's it. We, as poets, we speak up for what we value. And the other thing, which just reminded me, Lisa C., you know, she contacted me. She was writing for Publishers Weekly, and she met me at the Rose Cafe and interviewed me about that march. And she did a column on poetry and that particular thing.
For PW.
Yeah.
good.
Yeah, that's good. So, I think there are – here's one thing I think we should be thankful for. That period when Holly, when you reviewed, other poets reviewed books of poetry and other things, that was a valuable thing to do. So, we can't really lament it too much. It's just what exists, So we have to just keep – I think what we do as poets, we create our own community.
Well, that's what you've done.
Yeah.
And that's very inspiring. And I think L.A. is beginning to get, just like they did in the plastic, the painting and sculpture, they had this big series of exhibits at all the museums in Southern California celebrating Los Angeles. And the literary scene, is lagging behind, but there's that study that's been published by Beyond Baroque or in association with Otis. Have you seen that? It's for sale at Beyond Baroque. Yeah. Michael C. Ford gave me a copy.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's an academic study, but still it gives, the scene some of its
due. Well, there have been two of them. Bill Moore's what was it, Holdouts.
Yeah.
That came out a couple of years ago. And then this one by a French woman.
That's right.
Sophie Rockmull.
But even beyond that, what I think is important is there are people who look at the thing, but I think it's important for each one of us to tell our own history. Light a candle as opposed to damning the darkness. I remember one time I was down at UCSD La Jolla where each of our papers are in the Mandeville Special Collections Library. And there was a young woman, young compared to me. She taught down there. She's a New York writer, poet. I forget. Eileen Miles, maybe.
Oh, yeah, I know Eileen.
So we were sitting in the big, 20 people, and she said to me, not to me, but to people, I forget what the subject was. She said, I remember when I was a young poet, I went to St. Mark's Church, and there was Aram Saroyan writing poems, reading poems about the people he knew. And she said, I really, I could just write about my life, too. So, just that.
There you go.
Yeah, we just write, put our own. Tell our own history,
Right. Well,
did you want to talk about the beginning of Beyond Baroque, Aram? You want to hear about
that?
Beyond Baroque started in 1969 officially. Before that, George Drury Smith, he had been a teacher at Samo High, and then he went over and he bought this building on what Holly mentioned earlier, West Washington Boulevard, and then he became Abbot Kinney. And then he wanted to do a lit mag. And then he started doing Friday night readings and then music sometimes on Saturday, and then the Wednesday night poetry workshop, which I was one of the first members. I believe it started on February 26, 1969. And there were, people, as Holly mentioned, Wanda Coleman was in it, not the first part, but she came a little sooner. Leland Hickman, Michael C. Ford came, or Bill Moore came later. And then that still exists. So that's the central gathering place, and that's where most of us poets left. And the one thing I would like to just say about the workshop, the way it worked was you would read a poem, and then people would go around the room. If they had something, they would say it. You wouldn't argue with what they said.
No,
you just take
talk.
It in.
Yeah.
No. And then the head guy, there was John Harris and Joseph Hansen, and they would, kind of wrap it all up and give a little semblance of balance to it. But mainly we learned a lot from our fellow poets. And you would read a poem, and what was great about not only getting the feedback, sometimes it'd be 50 people in the class. It was during the hippie era, where a lot of people come off the streets. And so you read a poem, and Michael C. Ford would say, could I publish that for Sunset Palms Hotel? Bill Moore would say, I'd like to publish that in Momentum. Jim Crusoe would say, I'd like to publish that in the Beyond Baroque, whatever the manifestation of that particular time was, New Letters or Beyond Baroque, so-and-so. And that was one of the things. And then we all, moved forward from then.
Well, that's very similar to what was going on at Cafe Metro and then later, the Poetry Project in New York. Because, at that time, I'm talking mid, later 60s, there weren't that many poets per se. But you would meet at this coffee place. Diane Rutkowski might read. And then it seemed like every other poet was starting their own magazine. And maybe it only lasted, an issue or two issues. But a lot of times they'd say, okay, or can I send a poem? You'd ask, can I send a poem? And you'd send a poem. And that became, a de facto scene of some kind. You know?
There was grant money
yeah.
for small presses and magazines.
And teaching.
And in those years in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
the 70s and 80s, I would send work all over the country. There were marvelous small magazines, and they were supported by the National Endowment for the Arts, or CCLM. That money doesn't exist anymore.
See, that's why we started our press.
Right.
We'd each had books published, you know, by different presses, and then all of a sudden, as Holly said, the grants started drying up in the 80s. And even Beyond Broke one time used to get a certain amount of money. And so we said, well, you know, that whole thing, you know, take command, you know, do your own, you know, do the work.
DIY and do the work. Or whatever.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I got the idea from was from Norman Lear. He had a thing called TNT, and it's some – I don't know what it refers to. Some Jewish expression is put your money where your mouth is. You know, and then the first artists, you know, where you had Chaplin – Fairbanks, Mary Pickford, and Griffith, and they formed their thing, and they
did United Artists,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. And so we decided we would be like that, and we'd all chip in a little bit, and then we would put out our books and support each other and give each other total individual freedom. So that's, you know, that's
yeah.
a certain community right there, too.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
if I could just put in a word for Cahuenga Press, if your listeners are interested, you can visit cahuengapress.com and see profiles of the members and read poems by each of the members and order books.
And I should say these are beautiful books. I mean, the production
Thank you.
Value.
Thank you.
Well, and we always appreciate you come with your wife, Galen, and, you know, fellow poets, you know, we always have a party usually to kick it off at Phoebe McAdams, Ozuna's home, and she has a beautiful place, and it's like magic. And I know you've known her through, you know, New York City, Bolinas, et cetera.
Yeah.
You know, you've been – see, you've been a very important part of the poetry and the fiction, nonfiction world in writing, you know, for many, many years. And so, basically Holly and I have been here I've been here since 68, and you've been here since 1960.
Wow. Yeah. And you both – came from the same state, but you only met
here.
Yeah.
Here.
Many,
yeah.
many
yeah,
years
here's a,
later.
Holly came from the big city, Lincoln. I came from the little town, Sydney, like 368 miles away. But
yeah.
anyway, Lee Hickman, you know, he's the guy who turned me on to poetry, and he kept telling me in the mid-70s about, oh, you got to read this book, Feast. And it was by Holly Prado, and he kept talking about it. And I listened to him, and I said, oh, it sounds too feminine for me, too intricate. And finally, I bought it. I went into Papa Bach, and I bought it, and the bookseller knew who Holly was and who she had studied with, and I read it, and I fell in love with her writing. And so I called her up, and I ended up taking roses to her. I took it to the wrong place, but she did get the roses. But I fell in love with her writing,
kidding.
And then I fell in love with her.
Yeah, it's true.
What a great story.
That's true.
Yeah. And she had like three books published in like 76, 77, somewhere in there. And she was teaching at the Women's Building. So, you know, and her work really blossomed.
Fantastic.
Well, and I met so many people, and everyone was helpful. I think the atmosphere in Los Angeles, yes, there are cliques. Yes, there are various poetic sensibilities. But generally, people really want to cooperate with each other.
You know, there's some kind of give on the West Coast, because you think of someone like Allen Ginsberg, who'd struggled for years on the East Coast and been sort of the self-appointed agent for the Beat Generation, and then comes out to the West Coast and I think within a year wrote Howl.
Wow.
You know, he met Peter Orlovsky out here, and there's a kind of maybe a give in the atmosphere where in New York everything is tight, you know. And
it's tighter in San Francisco, too.
Well, he was in the Bay Area.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah. But, I mean, it is – I agree with you, but still compared to New York.
Yes, yes.
I don't know.
Well, it's like dress. I remember, you know, in New York when I was there, you'd put on your suit and tie, your attaché case, go out looking for acting work, end up at Hornet and Hart ads, or go see a movie on 42nd Street with your buddy. But then, you know, your top coats, you'd have a top coat. When you come to L.A., you take off your top coat.
Yeah.
You know, you put on your tennis shoes or your Rockport, and just the dress is much more casual, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you feel freer. You know, but it has to do with the traditions. You know, you had the Northwest, then you had New York City, then you had the Fugitive Poets, then you had New York City starting way back with Henry Dana 2 years before the man. L.A. has always been the movies. You know, the one thing, Robert Kirsch, you know, he was one of the best writers ever for the L.A. Times Book Review, and he wrote about an anthology that Hollywood called The Streets Inside 10 Los Angeles Poets, put up by Bill Moore. And in that first paragraph, this was 1978, I believe it was, yeah, and he says, if L.A. were San Francisco, where these things are more readily recognize what is going on in L.A. poetry right now would be called a golden age. But because of the movie business, the TV and the music business, it gets overshadowed,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he was the most trusted guy. I mean, if...
Well, I know. He was the Daily Reviewer for a while,
yeah.
There,
yes.
I think. Yeah. Should
All
we
right.
talk for a moment about
yeah.
Wanda? I mean...
Yeah, let's talk about Wanda.
I was a little distressed when... I mean, to me, this is just a sign of... New York's obtusity, that she didn't receive a proper obituary in the New York Times. You know, she was a big energy.
We're talking about Wanda Coleman,
yeah.
a poet very active in the Los Angeles poetry community for many, many years, certainly dating back to the early 1970s, late 1960s, and a very strong voice for African American women, for freedom of expression, and for being exactly who you are.
Well, you know, I always think that her energy really comes out more like Olson, but in an interview with Lee Hickman in Balky magazine, she talked about how she and one of her early husband, they met John Thomas's wife, Rose, who was teaching at Cal Arts. And they would go over to their house, and John had a lot of poetry, so she became friends with them. Then John introduced her to Bukowski, and then so she started reading Bukowski. And then she said, Jesus, if he can write like that, I can write like that too. So she started writing. So she wrote a letter to John Martin. So John Martin, Black Sparrow, says to her, all right, here's what I do with Bukowski. He just sends me his poems, and I keep them in a dresser drawer, and then I pick them out. We put a book together. So you do that with me too. So she started sending him poetry. So then it took – this was probably around 71 or 72. It wasn't until Mad Dog Black Lady – I don't know what year that came out, maybe 78, somewhere in there, 77, 78. That was her first one, and that's how she got published by Black Sparrow. Those were the
– He played an important role,
yeah.
John Martin.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. Black Sparrow Press certainly
yeah. And they didn't publish a lot of L.A. poets. I know you've been published by Black Sparrow, but Bukowski and Wanda, you know, you, a few others, Michael Lally. But that was a big deal.
Well, I mean, he, you know, he figured out a way to make the small press book work by doing limited signed and so on. And then, of course, he had Bukowski, who was like Stephen King for Viking,
sure.
making it possible, all boats yeah. rise with the tide, you know, making it possible to publish a variety of poets.
Yeah. I knew Wanda from, you know, Beyond Baroque. I knew when she went with a guy, an artist. I've been to their place where his art studio on West Washington. I knew it when she went with a poet named Paul
Brooks.
And then, you know, I knew her throughout the time. So I probably knew her as much as anybody, not family member, but we mm-hmm. we went to her memorial at a church, and I read a poem that I wrote to her. But she was a bigger-than-life, you know, wonderful poet.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
her husband, Austin Strauss, was a very important part of her life for yeah. a number of years.
Yeah. yeah.
And I like the clothes she wore, too, the dark greens and the hats.
Yeah, she did. Yeah.
And they did a poetry show here at KPFK.
Yeah.
Let's thank Wanda and Austin, and today, Aram,
and
very
Holly.
Much.
And Harry.
Thank you, Aram.
It's been a pleasure, you guys. Thank you.
Well, it's great, too, to be with you. You're one of the best poets and writers in America, and we're grateful that you asked
you
us.
Should come.
Hear, hear.
Yeah. I love it. Thanks, Harry. It's been a pleasure. This is Aram Saroyan at Poets Cafe, and it's been my pleasure to talk with Holly Prado Northup and her husband, Harry Northup. Thank you both.
Thank you.